I want to welcome you to the third week of our very long journey, verse by verse, through the entirety of God's inspired word. We're still in the book of the beginnings. In fact, we're really in the beginning of the book of the beginnings, the book of Genesis chapter 3. Everything that we've seen so far has established how God created the world out of nothing. He created everything with the intention of creating humanity, male and female, and putting them at the heart of this creative gift. Everything was very good until we arrive chapter 3, verse number 1, where we're introduced to a new character that I was talking about when we closed up things last week. Genesis 3:1 says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any beast of the field that he who is God," remember that's the way I'm treating the divine name this time through, "that he who is God had made." Now this serpent is clearly identified with Satan in the book of Revelation. Chapter 20, verse number 2, it says that the angel seized the dragon, the ancient serpent, that's a reference all the way back to this first book, who is the devil, and Satan, which is the Hebrew way of talking about an adversary, and it's the proper name that we use for Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So the serpent here in Genesis 3 is related to the serpent, the dragon, Satan, in Revelation chapter 20. The question has to be asked, though, is this Satan morphing into this creature that we call the serpent, or is he utilizing, perhaps even subjugating, some animal that we now refer to as the serpent? And I have to confess to you, I am not altogether certain what the answer is to that question. I have seen responses both ways. I had a seminary professor who was quite insistent that this eventual reference to Satan, the serpent being caused to go on his belly and eat the dust of the earth, was a Middle Eastern idiom for causing someone to grovel at your feet to show that you had conquered over them, and that this was God's way of saying Satan is defeated. And when I heard that, I could see some of the aspects kind of matching the Middle Eastern context, but it still bothered me that we have a very long-standing tradition that we don't like physical serpents, for the most part. There's a few people that seem to enjoy them, but for the most part, we humans have this gut reaction to them, and that this might be related to the fact that the animal we now know as the serpent was part of the curse of an animal previous to that that did not crawl on its belly, but rather seemed to have been upright or something. And there's a lot of stories about that throughout the many cultures of the world, and even imagery that's very ancient of flying serpents or walking serpents. So I'm going to just say we have to leave that as an uncertain question that we'll have to wait until the Lord can answer it for us. But we do know, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that Satan is involved in this story because of the Revelation 20 passage. At this point, I want to bring in a couple of other passages that help shed light on the identity of Satan and how he comes to be the enemy of mankind in this very story we're looking at in Genesis chapter 3. And part of my reason for doing it at this point is because there are some people that teach that Satan was part of some civilization previous to the creation of man that he rebelled during that period of time and became the enemy of mankind. These two passages that I'm about to share with you seem to tell a different story, that his status as our enemy occurred in Genesis 3. So first of all, we go to Isaiah chapter 14, where the prophet Isaiah is giving a prophecy against the king of Babylon. And as he describes the punishments and the bad attitude of this individual, he then seems to look behind the individual at the puppet master, the spiritual entity that's stirring the pot, because some of the things that he says here cannot literally be applied to the king of Babylon, but instead to the spirit entity that is manipulating the king of Babylon. So we pick up the context in Isaiah 14, verse 12, where we actually get some vocabulary that refers to Satan. How are you fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn? Now the phrase, O day star, in Hebrew is Halel. And it's the Hebrew word for brilliance, shining. It can even be applied, I believe, to sounds that are brilliant and have this special effect upon humanity. And that might feed into something that's about to come to light in these passages as well. It also is the Hebrew way of referring to the planet Venus, the brightest object in the sky after the sun and the moon. The Latin text at this point inserts the word that means the bearer of light, and also the Latin word that refers to the planet Venus again. And that word, as it was pronounced in the original Latin, was Lucifer. We have softened it since about the 4th century AD to Lucifer. And so this, we know, is one of the very old words we use in English to talk about Satan or the devil. So how have you fallen from heaven, Halel, Lucifer, son of dawn? How are you cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low? You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. Now, stars in Hebrew poetry is sometimes a reference to the angelic beings, the spiritual servants of God. And we know in the book of Revelation, chapter number 12, there is a picture of the dragon, which is Satan, drawing down a third of the stars with his tail at some point in history. And many of us have identified that with the rebellion that we're looking at in Genesis chapter 3. And so here Isaiah seems to have part of Lucifer, Satan's plot, is to grab some of the angelic host for himself. Continuing the text, I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north, which is often a poetic reference to heaven itself. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. And there's zero doubt there about the intent, because Most High is the most ancient terminology for the Creator God. So Isaiah chapter 14 does in fact seem to be a reference to Satan's intentional attempted coup against God, and to try to take away the support of the servant class, the spiritual servant class of the universe, into his power, to try to be the one that everybody has to answer to. And so this is his his self-centeredness, his narcissism that suddenly comes to the forefront. Then we need to go over to Ezekiel chapter 28 to have another view of Satan before he descends into this ego trip and what he was doing in the Garden of Eden as part of the very good creation. So Ezekiel 28, we have the prophet Ezekiel, this time being given prophetic information against the king of Tyre. But in the midst of it, just like we saw in the book of Isaiah, the prophet seems to look behind the human to the puppeteer, to the spiritual entity that is stirring the pot, causing trouble. Because the things that are applied are not things that could be literally said of the king of Tyre. And we see things like this in other places in Scripture, that God looks beyond the things going on in the human world to the things that are going on in the spirit world. So this is what it says in the second half of verse number 12 in Ezekiel 28. You were the signet of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. So this identifies Satan as being present in the Garden of Eden. Then it describes every precious stone was your covering. Sardius, topaz, diamond, beryl, onyx, jasper, sapphire, emerald, carbuncle, crafted in gold were your settings and your engravings. On the day that you were created, they were prepared. Now this I find intriguing, and I allow my speculation to run a little wild, and I'm going to just let you kind of follow along with me. You don't have to accept it. This is my opinion, folks. This seems to describe Satan as being almost like a living jewel, that he is not flesh and blood. And we know that that's true of angelic beings. They are not flesh and blood. Instead, he seems to be made up of precious minerals, and that he is a living jewel. And verse 14, you were an anointed guardian cherub. And the word for guardian here has the idea of surrounding or barricading. Now, in the Garden of Eden, at the beginning, there was no need for a barricade against evil. That will come later when we will see in Genesis 3, God puts some cherubim, these four-faced, four-winged angelic beings, as a barrier against mankind getting to the Tree of Life. At the time when everything was perfect, though, this word may have simply referenced those in close attendance. And so my speculation is we have Satan when he was Hallel, the shining one, which would match the idea of a living jewel. He is in the Garden of Eden, and he is effectively being the companion of God whenever he visits. And that he is also there to be the escort, perhaps even for mankind, for Adam and Eve, whenever they are meeting with God. And we know that God came and walked every day with Adam and Eve. I kind of skipped over the idea of what these cherubim look like. We can go to the book of Ezekiel to get that answer. In chapter 1, and also again in chapter number 10, we find out that these angelic beings were pretty much humanoid in form, but they had four faces and four wings. The four wings covered their hands. The four faces consisted of a human face, a bovine or bull-like face, a lenine or lion-like face, and an eagle face. And this is interesting because the other class of angels that we are specifically told about would be the seraphim, the shining or burning angels. There's only four of them cited in Scripture. Isaiah chapter 6 is the first place we run into them by name. And then later they show up in the book of Revelation. They seem to be flying around the actual throne of the Most High and saying, "Holy, holy, holy." These seraphim have the same four faces on the four individual seraphim that each of the cherubim have on their four faces. So there's parallelism here. In the architecture, the God-given architecture of the tabernacle and then of the temple, the cherubim are very prominent. And so what I'm suggesting to you, actually teaching you at this point, is that Satan, in his original existence as Hillel, was one of the cherubim who lived in the Garden of Eden. It says it right here in the book of Ezekiel. All right, back to verse 14, a little bit more. "You are an anointed guardian cherub. I placed you. You were in the holy mountain of God." When we talk about holy mountain, often that is a poetic reference to the place where God is on his throne, where he is in his element, where he is reigning from. And in this case, it's applied to the Garden of Eden as well. Because before sin entered into the world, the Garden of Eden was an extension of God's eternal kingdom. Remember, everything was very good. Another phrase, "In the midst of the stones of fire you walked." That has an interesting reference back to the book of Ezekiel, because at one point the angels are described as having these wheels that are wheels within wheels, and they're glowing. And so it's possible that we've got a little bit of a reference to things related to those, but in the book of Isaiah, the coals of fire that are underneath the altar, or excuse me, underneath the throne, the seraphim, I believe it was, reach in there and grab one of those coals of fire and touch Isaiah's lips with them and say that you're now cleansed of your sin and you are capable of speaking for God. There seems to be a symbolism that in relationship to the throne of God, there was this space underneath his throne, which would have been between the cherubim, that housed these glowing coals, these glowing stones, and that this is somehow related to the altar of prayer, where the priests would put glowing embers and use that to ignite the incense that symbolized the prayers to God. So what I would say to you is that somehow all of this imagery is related to communication with God by mankind, and that Satan was right there in the midst of that conduit of communication. But that was when he was still Hillel. He was still the shining one, the living jewel, the one who had not yet fallen into the sin of self-centeredness. Verse 15, "You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you." And so I believe Genesis 3, Isaiah chapter 14, Ezekiel chapter 28, And then a few passages, in particular in the New Testament, that talk about the ego, the pride of Satan being the centerpiece of his fall. All of these passages paint a much more colorful picture of this entity that we know now is the enemy of our souls. He had a prominent place in the original creation. He seems to have been right there in the middle of the story in the book of Eden, or in the book of Genesis, in the Garden of Eden, with God present and with mankind, human, Adam and Eve present. And then something happened to make him change. He had some sort of free will that allowed him to abandon his original purpose of serving God. And this is where I'm going to bring something in from extra-biblical writings and traditions. So bear with me for one more moment before we can get back to the text in Genesis and talk about the inspired story. But there is a long-standing tradition among Muslims. It was very early in the starting of the Islamic faith. And many of the stories in Islam were taken straight out of Judaism. We know that. And so this story, which I believe has its roots in Jewish tradition, is that when God created Adam and Eve and then told the angels, you must treat them as you would treat me, because they are made in my image and my likeness. So effectively, the angels were told to offer worship to mankind. And we know that angels are servant class. Hebrews chapter 1, verse number 14. Do you not know that they are ministering spirits sent to see to the needs of those who inherit salvation? So they've always been the servants of God, and through that, the servants of humanity. There is a passage that may even hint at the idea that God required all the angels to worship Adam and Eve. But the tradition in Islam, and by extension from Judaism that they kind of ripped it off from, is that when God made that requirement, Satan's heart darkened. And he took offense at this because mankind was lower in abilities than himself. They were flesh and blood. They apparently couldn't even go back and forth between dimensions like the angelic creatures could do. And so he took offense at it and decided he was not going to go down that path, and that's when the rebellion started in his heart. And then he started plotting his coup. I will become like the Most High. I will compromise the angelic world. I will take charge of the universe. And that what happens next in the book of Eden, in the book of Genesis, in the Garden of Eden, was his first shot in that war. So he does not go against God right off the bat. He instead attacks humanity. And he doesn't attack them head on. He instead tries to compromise them. So let's go back to Genesis 3 at this point. We've got a few minutes left today, and then we will set the stage for tomorrow's continuation of this story. So here we have Satan in the form of the serpent, the dragon. Chapter 3, verse 1, second half, he said to the woman, did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden? So he begins with a question, which temptation often begins with that. It's planting doubt in the mind. The woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that's in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. And that's a reference to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. the very thing that God put there as the instrument by which Adam and Eve could exercise their free will clearly. Now, Eve had not yet been created when we first saw this tree, so Adam was the one that was given the instruction, but Eve seems to have also been given instruction, and it's even intensified. Don't even go near it. Don't touch it. Because if you do, you will most certainly die. Remember the Hebraism I told you about, dying you shall die? Then Satan lives up to one of his most ancient titles, the liar, the slanderer, which is diabolos in Greek, and that's where we get the word devil. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die." So he contradicts God. Verse 5, "For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." And now we see a very classic case of transference. Satan is the one that wants to be like God. He wants to be like the Most High. In fact, he wants to take over the universe from the Most High. But he lays it out as, you know what the problem is? God doesn't want you to really be like him. God's holding out on you. He's keeping something good from you. And of course, this is not true. This is a lie. But Satan has couched it in such a way as to excite the curiosity and the thoughtful consideration of Eve and whether or not she should believe God or Satan. And we'll come back tomorrow and get into the word with the rest of this story.